Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 375 of The Law Entrepreneur. 375, can you believe that? I'm Ewan Fiver, your host once again. And today, my guest is none other than my friend David Berkus. Now, David is one of my favorite authors. I first met David when he published a book called Friend of a Friend. And as you may know, if you've listened to this program for any length of time, to me, it's the single best book ever written about networking and the science behind networking, and more specifically, relationship marketing. Fabulous book. If you haven't read Friend of a Friend, go get it, read it. You'll thank me later. David has a new book out that we're going to talk about today called Best Team Ever. It's all about the science behind team building. And I keep saying science because David originally is a college professor and has done extensive study about organizational teamwork and organizational psychology. So there's a lot of science behind it, and his writing style is so conversational, is so easy to read that it really brings these concepts out. So I couldn't be more thrilled to have David back on the program today to talk about his new book, Best Team Ever, and I hope you enjoy it. So without any further delay, here's David Berkus. David Berkus, welcome back to The Law Entrepreneur.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. I normally say thank you for having me, but having me back, right? That I assume that means the last time went pretty well, right?
Oh, it did. Ears really should be burning. I'll get to that in a little bit. But for those who may not be familiar with the name, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Yeah. So my name is David Berkus, obviously. I'm an organizational psychologist by training, was a business school professor for about a decade. Around COVID, I kind of stepped out of the university because I just had a ton of clients to work with directly, whether it be through speaking or running workshops or just kind of consulting to leadership teams directly around how do we respond? How do we work remotely? How do we work in a hybrid environment? How do we return to office? And really kind of realize that is a broader conversation about what does our culture look like and how do we create a culture of high performance no matter what work arrangement we choose, which is a team by team question. It kind of leads to why we're getting together today.
Well, let me just then complete that loop, because David, if you listen to this podcast for any length of time, you know that I've always named three books as my top three books that I think every solo and small firm practitioner should read. I don't rank them one, two, and three. I think they're all number one in my view. And ironically, I'm going to have two of these of those three authors on the show within the last week. So one is Joey Coleman, who we had on last week, wrote his second book called Never Lose an Employee Again. The second one is James Clear, who wrote the phenomenal book, Atomic Habits. And the third one is my friend here, David Berkus, who I've said to many, many people, has wrote the best book on networking and relationship marketing called Friend of a Friend than I ever read.
Oh, well, so, thank you. And yeah, no, that book's how we found each other, right? Because you read that and then reached out to me. Yeah.
That's correct. And I know you've written a lot of other things since then. But that book to me, you know, in an age when, let me go on my soapbox for just a second, in an age when most books deserve to be magazine articles, and most magazine articles deserve to be a blog post, and most blog posts could be said with a tweet, okay? I thought what just blew me away about Friend of a Friend was that two things. One, how beautifully it was written, conversationally it was written. Felt like I was talking to you throughout every page of the book. And number two, how well researched it was and how complete the thought, the premise was. And it thoroughly researched, thoroughly footnoted, as you would expect a college professor at the time to. And it sets it apart from most of what I think at times is drivel in business writing world. So that should maybe not come as a surprise to the listeners, maybe come as a surprise to you. But I've always said that book was the best book on networking, relationship building, marketing that I ever read. And I probably read it two or three times.
Oh, you are too. I will be honest with you.
I'm thrilled about the new book that we're here to talk about.
Yeah.
Because I think it, I have every expectation, having read parts of it, that I'm going to feel the same way.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'll be honest with you. I am one of my favorite negative reviews of Friend of a Friend is there's like a 2-star review and it says, this reads like a collection of Medium posts. And I wrote back and said, well, thank you. Yeah. You said collection, right? Not one, not this whole book could have been a Medium post. You said reads like a collection. I'm like, great. That means you got something useful out of every chapter, right? Isn't that what that means? So I've tried to sort of lean even more into that conversational style with this new one, Best Team Ever, and what have you. And very, very aligned. Joey Coleman and I, Joey's a brilliant mind. We're old friends. Very, very aligned. I think he and I are coming at the same problem most business owners, especially, you know, legal entrepreneurs are facing right now around talent and experience. And, you know, his, how do you never lose an employee? How do you create an employee experience that has retention? Mine's much more, well, one, now that you've retained those people, now that they're engaged, how do we turn that into performance? But we're kind of coming at that same problem.
Yeah. And I think it addresses the aspect of a law firm's development that is the only thing that people talk about right now. In part, that's coming out of COVID, but also in part, I think this is just where we are in the life cycle of law firms, the business side of law firms. And that is, how do you get great people? How do you keep them? And how do you mold them into a team? Mm-hmm. Because if you can't do all three of those things, you're probably not going to be successful. So that's why I'm super excited to dive into the book a little bit and understand, you know, you touched on what was the idea behind getting started on writing the book. What did you learn along the way? I mean, that's kind of a broad open question.
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest lesson that I've learned over the last 3 years, so before I started writing the book, but also in exploring the book, is just how bogus a term like company culture is.
Yeah.
Right?
So I'm so glad you said
that. Yeah. So that's not to say that culture doesn't matter, right? But it's seen and it's experienced much more on a team level than it is an entire company. Now, granted, depending on, like, if you're listening to this, depending on the size of your firm, you might be the only leader. You might only have 8 people. But if you've got, you know, if there are multiple managers in place, every team is going to have a different experience of what it's like to work. And that's what matters to them, not to like whole company. Yeah.
Well, I've always been amused by, you know, obviously attorneys in this space, that I want to work on my firm's culture.
Mm.
I'm like, really? Isn't culture the product?
Yeah. Well,
lots of other things. And so, I don't think you can start out with, I have a culture in mind.
Yeah.
And let me engineer backwards to figure out what I need to do. And what your book does is identify, it's like 3 pillars upon which team building is done. And as a result, culture emerges.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great way to put it, right? Like, I think when I work with most folks and they talk and say, we want to work on our culture, I want to work on the culture of my firm, right? If you're part of this audience, what they're actually saying is they want to create a bunch of little sort of like trinkets or rituals that look like they flow out from culture, right? We're like, a lot of times when we talk about culture, we talk about, you know, kombucha or beer on tap in the break room or a foosball table, right? Or the fact that actually we dress a little more casually than most firms or what have you. And those are all like, those are all outward appearances of what is fundamentally, and I think this is funny because one of your other top three books is Atomic Habits. Fundamentally, what we're talking about or what you should be working on are the habits and norms of behavior of the people that work for you and how we work together, right? And you could call that three elements of team building, right? You could call that the habits around collaboration and how we interact. You know, I look at it and I kind of call it these three elements of team culture, and then your company's culture, your whole firm's culture is just an amalgamation of all of those individual team cultures, those habits and norms of behavior that's what you work on. And then the outward symbols that people look at to say, wow, they've got a great culture. Those are all downstream from doing the work of team building, doing the work of building those team-wide habits.
Yeah. And one of the things that struck me is that the team culture, if you will, the commonality of things that the team does are not uniform across a company or across a law firm. You know, companies have different teams within their corporation, their organization. Law firms, frankly, have different teams. You have intake team, you have the operations team, then you have the legal.
Right.
And building that team is different or has a different need. But what your book does is then is boil that down and say, well, what's universal across teams? And you have three basic principle, and they follow the three basic units of the book. So can you share with the audience what those are and how those relate to each other?
Yeah. So fundamentally, what every great team has in common, right? It's a bit like that Tolstoy novel, Anna Karenina, right? All happy families are alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own unique way. Teams are kind of the same way. Every great high-performing team is pretty similar to other ones. Every dysfunctional team might be dysfunctional in its own unique way. But those three similarities, we call them common understanding, psychological safety, and pro-social purpose. Common understanding, psych safety, and pro-social purpose. And common understanding is sort of the basics of what we might call role clarity. It is how much the team understands or has a shared understanding of expertise, assigned tasks, right? Deadlines, who's doing what and by when, but also of people, how well they have a common understanding about this person's specific work preferences, their personality, kind of the differences, but also similarities between us. So it's like I describe it as a mix of clarity and empathy. You have clarity of your role, but you also have empathy for everyone you're working with, and that helps you work better with them, right? Psychological safety, the second element, is how well the team feels to every individual member feels safe for interpersonal risk taking. And risk comes in a lot of forms, right? Speaking up when you disagree, especially if you're, you know, an associate, a junior associate, even more so, right? So speaking up is a risk. Sharing a crazy idea is a risk. Being vulnerable, admitting kind of a weakness is a risk. All of those are forms of interpersonal risk taking that we do to people and that we need on a team. But a lot of teams, especially in the legal profession, a lot of times we don't feel safe for that risk taking. We don't want to admit vulnerabilities because vulnerabilities might become liabilities, and then we've got a huge problem, right? And so we're not talking about, and we're just talking about internal conversations, right? Like I understand that from a legal perspective to the clients and the outside world, but internally you can't hide those flaws. Everybody knows what they are anyway, right? And a team kind of works better together, not only because we as humans learn through failure, and so if we're talking about failure more often, we're learning more often. But also because those crazy ideas, those disagreements that when you allow that productive friction to happen, unlock better ideas, that helps you serve clients better as well. And speaking of serving clients, that last element is a sense of pro-social purpose, which is specifically not just purpose. You know, this term why has been really popular in the last 10 to 15 years. And I don't have anything against why. I think it's great. I just point out in the book that the answer that will be most motivating to people to the question why usually comes in the form of who, as in who is served by the work that we're doing. If you can point to that, here's why we're working so hard. And by the way, in a larger firm, this may not be end clients. As in a larger firm, this might be who you support, like the intake team their who is often the people, the legal team, right? Because if they don't do a good job on that, the legal team can't operate. So that who we're serving by doing a great job, that needs to be specific to every team, and it needs to stay top of mind on that team to keep them bonded together and motivated.
I'm curious how you were able to distill the research into these three tenets.
Yeah.
Because, when I read the first book, and you quote so magnificently from all studies and experiments in world psychology, and really made it attainable for a reader like me, I was curious, did the structure for the book come from his reading thousands upon thousands of studies, or did it come from some other external source? And I would ask the same question here, because I know that this book is chock full of stories, real world stories about teams that had a challenge or overcame an issue. And I see how they illustrate the point in the book. Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah, so the research comes first. Friend of a Friend is similar to this, which you loved and Leading from Here. I almost always start from the research, right? And in the world of organizational psychology, that's just my background. That's my recovering academic. In the world of organizational psychology, there is a lot, probably 40 plus years of really decent research on team culture specifically. Psychological safety, that's a concept that goes back probably 35 years, right? Okay. Purpose and motivation. But then we talk about specific elements like Anita Williams Woolley's concept of collective intelligence and the advantages of having empathy or social sensitivity on a team. And then we have the ideas around organizational citizenship behaviors and all of this sort of stuff. And suffice to say, there have been attempts in the past to go, okay, we have these, it's probably, if you look at every individual researcher that's really done groundbreaking work on team culture, you probably arrive somewhere between 7 and 10 different kind of like principles. But there's a lot of overlap in those principles, right? And so then there was an attempt to kind of boil it down to, okay, what are the core? And we got to 5. And I'm just going to be totally transparent here. I think 5 is too many. I think it's too hard to remember 5 things, especially when you're also trying to run a business. Okay? And so we got a little creative, pro-social purpose leverages not only purpose and the motivation and intrinsic motivation behind purpose, but also pro-social, which leverages that kind of organizational citizenship behavior I was talking about earlier. Common understanding kind of leverages a couple different things around a team's collective intelligence and a team's coordination and role clarity and what have you. Probably the only one that was untouched in terms of me not trying to get creative in combining different pillars of research is psychological safety. And that's because it is probably the single most consistent finding of the last almost 40 years around teamwork and collaboration, is that a team with psychological safety, all other things being equal and sometimes not being equal, a team with psychological safety will win far more often than a team that doesn't have it.
Just find that fascinating, because to me, that was the most interesting part of the three-legged stool, the psychological safety, because you deal with this whole concept of establishing trust amongst mm-hmm. teammates and also trust with whomever the team is serving, and respect between
yeah.
teammates and respect within the organizational structure. And I think, as an attorney's man, those are, if you had to make a list of the qualities of a great law firm or a great attorney, I think most attorneys would put trust and respect pretty far down.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I agree with you.
They don't really think of it. Now, the ones that are doing a great job, they have it really high up in their list.
Yeah.
Right? Particularly respect.
Yeah. And it's interesting, right? Because they're two elements of psychological safety, but we can think of them as two distinct things, but they're really actually the same side of the coin as it pertains to leading a team, right? I have to have a certain level of trust in you, Neil, in order to be vulnerable in front of you, or to disagree with you and know I'm not going to get my head ripped off, or to speak up and share that crazy idea and know I'm not going to be berated for having a ridiculous, fantasy. But I have to have some initial level of trust. But then when I do the action, when I take the risk, I have to feel respected, heard, listened to, considered. Even if we don't go with my idea to begin with, I have to feel like you took my suggestion seriously and we had a real conversation about it instead of you just saying, no, we don't have the budget for that. We're going with my way, right? And so there's sort of two different things that happen on the opposite. It creates this like virtuous or vicious cycle, right? Virtuous meaning people trust, so they step out on a risk and you respect, so they trust you more, so they risk more, so you respect more. Like or it can be a vicious cycle. And that's what I think is happening, like you said, in those differences between different firms, right? Just the interpersonal, maybe they're doing it intentionally, maybe we just got lucky, right? But the interpersonal nature of the people leading those firms is one that they respond to divergent ideas with respect. They understand when people are being vulnerable and treat them with honor and with respect. And then there are other firms that sort of don't teach that. And so the vicious cycle, and it creates this stark contrast because it always compounds. It's not just a simple like close little difference between the good and the great. The gap will be wider and wider and wider because the cycle will continue to compound.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby, the number one client communication solution for growing legal practices. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Ruby creates exceptional experiences for your callers and website visitors. They take messages, screen and transfer callers, schedule appointments, perform new client intake, confirm details with outbound calls, and can answer in English and Spanish, and a whole lot more. Just like an in-house receptionist, only better, because they turn every ring into a relationship. Ruby can work full-time, part-time, or as a backup, and you can change your instructions anytime with their top-rated mobile app and online dashboard. Plus, Ruby integrates with tools such as Clio, Lexicalada, MyCase, and Rocket Matter. It all adds up to more opportunities and more time saved. In fact, 90% of legal professionals who use Ruby capture more billable hours than the national average, with many recording double or more. That's 5 or more billable hours per day. To experience the Ruby difference for yourself, visit get.ruby.com/ELE. That's get.ruby.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, for up to $150 off your first month. Imagine you, powered by Ruby. As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Kindler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game-changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.oncehub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit. I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I've been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor, get that free call and check out Ryan Kimler at netprofit.com.
And I saw that dramatically illustrated, when talking to attorneys during the pandemic, when we were still doing the podcast, and they were trying to maintain their team and get work done. And the ones that were doing a great job were the ones that, in my humble opinion, were respecting their employees' decisions about the workplace and where they were working and how they were working, and were trusting that they were getting the job done and supporting the firm. The ones that had the biggest problems were the ones that said to me explicitly, I hate this remote work environment. I can't see them. I can't make sure that they're actually work. And so they did, there was a lack of trust and a lack of respect, and those teams weren't working well.
Yeah. Yeah. I lost count of how many times I got asked, but, you know, because I wrote Leading From Anywhere, which is about how do you manage a remote or a hybrid team when that's not what you signed up for, when that's not your training, et cetera. And one of the questions I get asked all the time by people of that is like, okay, but what software should I use to monitor people activity? I'm like, what? Like, if you need a software to monitor whether or not people are doing their job, you screwed up a couple clicks back and you should probably go back and fix that, right?
I'm pretty certain, I've said that multiple times on this podcast, I'm pretty certain I read that. illustrated to me, you know, in really stark terms, because it's just the psychological safety of team building, making sure that people have that trust and respect. I think that was, to me, that was the one that resonated. Common understanding, I used to think of that as institutional memory or institutional understanding. So, as you said, being clear on what purpose is and being able to recognize in an empathetic way how we relate as a team. I think that is clearly part of it. From social purpose, let's talk about that for a moment, because one of the things I see a lot of law firms is kind of trying to put that out front about what they are doing, how it's the community it serves, and in some cases, even picking a charitable element to kind of focus on to make sure that they have a responsible social presence out there. How does that relate?
Yeah. So, I mean, let me say fundamentally, I think if you're a legal entrepreneur, especially, but if you're in law, you're there to serve. Now, not everybody goes to law school to serve, right? A lot of people go because they felt like they could make a lot of money, or a lot of people go because everybody told
them they're better lawyers.
Right. Those people tend to have burned out, right? So if you've been in the profession longer than maybe the first 10 years of your career, you're probably there for some other reason, right? And so I agree with you. Why not put it at the front? So pro-social purpose specifically refers to, can we answer that question, who is served by the work that we do? And there's a couple different research lines here that really point to why this matters so much in teams. The first is a lot of research that was spearheaded actually by Adam Grant, kind of before he was Adam Grant, right? Around what he called pro-social motivation. So there's this concept in organizational psychology called task significance. People want to know that the work they're doing matters. They want to be able to see a connection between their day-to-day activities and some other impact, whether it be a completed project, increased revenue, or what have you. And Adam made this argument 15 years ago that the number one way to convey task significance to an individual is to show them the person that they're impacting. So pro-social motivation. You motivate people by showing how their work protects or promotes the well-being of other people. It turned out in later research, moving off on all that ideas, that you actually saw an increase when you had an intervention, and that's a fancy psychological term for, like, you know, basically telling somebody a story or letting them meet the beneficiary of their work. But when you had an intervention that inspired that sense of pro-social motivation, you also saw increases in that individual's what we call organizational citizenship behaviors, which are a fancy, stupid organizational psychology term for teamwork. In other words, people worked better with other people when they knew that their work, when they knew who was served by their work, that their work mattered to this specific group of people. So you combine that with some other research around what are called superordinate goals, goals that are so big and so impactful that they require kind of interdependence. And you start to see, this isn't actually about motivating on an individual level. This is actually about how that who question can bring people together. And you see this all the time. Companies that are smart enough to engage in giving back and corporate social responsibility, whatever you want to call it, you can see the bonds that get built from the people that show up to that Habitat for Humanity exercise or show up for that 10K or what have you. In that moment of doing that work that makes them feel good because they know they're helping someone, they're more bonded to everybody else who's helping to do that, right? Well, that applies to your work too. That's not something you just have to do in addition to our work. You can tell those same stories about how the work that we're doing serves specific people. You can share the stories of clients that were helped, or even internally through things like properly written thank you notes and stuff. You can really inspire people by telling them, not only by answering the question, who is served by the work that we do, but by telling them often who is served and reminding them and keeping them top of mind on that who.
I give you kind of an example here, and some of our listeners are going to be tired of hearing me reference my friend Christy Zlakis' law firm that's here locally in the Washington area. It's a family law firm. They do, you know, divorces, custody matters. But they're also very focused on animals, right? So the whole law firm is animal friendly. You bring your dog to work days every day. They do a bunch of things charitable as a law firm in support of animal welfare. And everybody that's in that firm has the same social purpose. They know they serve families, and families oftentimes, particularly in, you know, high conflict stages, the divorces and custody issues and that kind of thing, you know, oftentimes a pet is the salvation. And so this whole thing works together for their team, and they have built this feeling amongst them that who they serve is families, and it's really evident, not just in the work that they do, but the charitable causes that they support. And everybody's on that same page. And I got a sense that this is part of what you're talking about in terms of team building.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, right? It's interesting too, because family law is one where, you know, if you've ever had to go through a divorce or something like that, you start to wonder often, man, the only people who are going to win in the end are these two people's lawyers, right? And so I think when you are one of those lawyers, it can be awfully hard to remember kind of who is served by that situation, that getting this done right and done well makes the difference in how these families will continue to operate, right? There's a scene I'm thinking of in the third season of Ted Lasso. Great show, by the way. The first couple episodes of the third season were a little like, meh, but then when they decided, hey, we're bringing it home at the end of this season, so let's close all the loops, it was really, really good. But there's a line, you know, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but Ted has having marital issues with his wife and the mother of his child. And there's a line in there where he says, you know, we're going to have grandkids together, right? Like, so we may not stay married, but we're still family, what have you. And so reminding people of that our work in this legal profession is going to affect, it's not that we're helping the split of this family, or this family's changing and evolving, and we are helping them get to that level, that next stage, hopefully as efficiently as possible, as effectively as possible, and what have you. And so keeping that, and the pet's idea is a great idea of just helping them deal with the trauma of what they're going through when they come visit us and what have you. I think that's exactly right. Right. And I don't think you have to go to that extreme, by the way. I really don't. You know, you don't have to have like a petting zoo
in your office.
But just sharing the success stories again, just bringing in like, what if at your, let's say, summer meeting where you get everybody together, your Christmas party, what if you invited some of your clients not to say thank you to the client, but to ask them to talk about their experiences and to show, to let people interact again with those people you probably forgot because we stopped working with them in March, but no, your work really did impact them and here's how it did, right? So what if we brought those back and told those stories again, or even just capture them? We don't have to bring the people in, but just capture them and share them out on a regular basis. That can go an awfully long way in reminding the team that even though we might be having a little bit of struggles, a little bit of like communication errors and conflict, we're doing this for a specific reason. And that means that's what I mean when I say organizational citizenship behaviors, right? That means I have to swallow my pride and my identity and do what's right for the good of the organization and the people it serves. And reminding people who that good is makes them much more likely to do that, to put that team first and that put that we over me, as it were.
Well, I have that, you know, the same issue in my own practice. I'm a reformed family law attorney and now do estate planning. And so it's really easy for me to connect with those families that I've served and to illustrate the positive impact that doing a proper estate plan or helping them navigate through the probate process at very stressful times helps when I talk to my employees about why we do what we do, because we're helping these families. And it's a difficult time of transition, probably no more difficult time of a family's transition than when they're dealing with the death of a loved
one. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, reconnecting with the why, so to speak, of what you're doing, but really more to, as you said, to the point, the who you serve by what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's really important. I want to touch on a couple of other things before I let you go. I know you're a lot to do. I mentioned this briefly in passing. I want to stop, pause, and say to our audience that David has one of the best news.
Oh.
And you know, I was going to say this, but you know, I've subscribed to a lot of newsletters and I unsubscribe to a lot of dribble. I'm still an active subscriber to David's newsletter. I look forward to it every week. I read it every week. I don't always, honestly, I don't always follow the rabbit hole links down to other stuff. But if you get nothing out, our listeners, if you get nothing else out of today's episode, just go to his website, sign up for his newsletter. You'll thank me later.
Oh, thank you. I'm curious. Do you read the article? Do you listen as a podcast, or do you watch the videos most often? Which when you do click the links, really cute.
I'm more the video.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So one of the things I feel weird bragging about my own newsletter, but one of the big content realizations I had, partly because I had time because of COVID, is that different people consume content differently, and so now we put out every Monday morning. We put out. I don't want to say the same piece of content because there are subtle differences, but fundamentally the same principles, the same idea, the same training. I started to use the term training for it, but we do it in video, audio, or written form, whatever, because I've given up trying to figure out what the preference of the majority of people are and just decided to serve all of them, right? And so whichever one you want, it's an intro and then a link to whichever form of that content you consume most often.
But I'm going to tell you that I think you're brilliant having all three, because there are weeks when I'm going to listen to it in the car. There are weeks when I'm going to read it, sitting, looking out at the ocean. There are times when I'm sitting in my office and I'm just going to watch the video.
Mm.
And so while I principally click through on the video link, I definitely consume all three. And I like I said, I subscribed to it way back when we first met, and I'm still a subscriber, and I still get a ton of value out of it. My friends know. I keep shooting them off links to it. I have a friend who's transitioning in the human resources world these days, and I'm sending it to her and so that she can have all this team building knowledge when she gets to her new job. So I would say that, and you're. YouTube channel is spectacular too.
No.
A lot of the videos obviously linked to the YouTube channel, but if you're a YouTube junkie like I am, I subscribe to your channel, and so I get I know when all the
Thank you. You know, and we put a lot of in YouTube, they call them shorts, and Instagram they're reels, and TikTok they're talks, whatever. But a lot of throughout the rest of the week, we're putting a lot of that short form content in. And actually, we crossed a milestone about 2 months ago where the majority of our views now come from those, that short hit comes
short
than the long videos, which has really been interesting. Sort of a, I don't know what that says about us as a society.
but our attention, you should know you're an organizational.
Right. Yeah. But
it's obvious our attention span is shorter.
Yeah. And the goal is like, yeah, the goal is not to fight it, right? Kind of like putting it in all three formats. The goal is, okay, well, if this is what people are consuming content in, then here's how the format I need to be helpful in order to be most helpful to them. Yeah.
Now, along with writing the book, you also develop some training behind it, right? Or in conjunction with.
Yeah. So you're talking about the course. Yeah. So we do. Yeah. There's a broader course called Build Your Best Team Ever. That is actually it's available for anybody. It's available for absolutely anybody. The majority of the time, what it becomes is when I work directly with a client. So I come in and and give a speech or come in and give a training, et cetera. It's a way of doing what I call aftercare, right? Taking care of them afterwards and what have you. However, we just made it available to everybody who bought the book, right? As kind of a reward for everybody who bought the book. And so I, you didn't have to pin me in the corner to offer this to you, Neil, but what we did that as kind of a launch week thing. But I'll tell you what, if you are listening to this episode and you decide to go ahead and get the book and you send me your receipt and say, hey, I heard you on Neil's show and grab the book, I'll go ahead and add you into that course too. That was something we were usually only doing for launch week. But since you mentioned we got so much value out of it, we'll offer it to anybody who's a fan of this show. Just shoot me an email and it'll be pretty easy to find my email. or connect with me on any of the socials like we talked about.
I apologize for jumping on that. I misunderstood, but
no, it's not a problem. Like I said, it's still available. People do purchase it one off for sure. But the majority of clients are kind of corporate. But you know,
I think that's really important, frankly, because you know you can read a million books, but until you actually put what you've learned in a book into action, you know, you're not really getting anywhere, are you? And yeah. I like the idea that it's aftercare. I always thought the newsletter was aftercare.
Well, it can sometimes be that too. Yeah, that's true. That's true. No, this was. Let's call the newsletter, like, if you read any of my work and you just want to stay in touch, this is more specific to Best Team Ever, and it's very action focused. And I'll be honest, it's less like if you read the book and you managed to take the book and figure out how to take action on the ideas yourself. Then the course may or may not be valuable to you. But if you read it and you're like, wow, this is really entertaining and great research or what have you, but I still haven't figured out exactly how to do this with my team, what have you, that's where the course comes in. Because it's just quick hit. Here's an activity. Do this activity. Let me know how it works. Here's the work.
Most solo small firm practitioners want people to think for it.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
I want that road map. So great. Well, thank you, David, for taking the time to be with us today. I can't tell you how much I do appreciate it and how much I do appreciate your work. Really, you're way up there on my list of influential and informative people, and I couldn't be more thrilled.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode. Our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them. And I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO. As I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.